Money, the Mark Steiner Show, is sponsored in part by the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development. Mortgage late? Don't wait. If you're struggling with your mortgage, the state of Maryland is offering housing counseling and legal assistance. Maryland's HOPE program can even help you understand the state's mediation law and the Attorney General's national foreclosure settlement. Don't wait. Get help today. More information at mdhope.org or at 877-462-7555. And this is the Mark Steiner Show in our new time, 9 to 11 a.m. We'll be followed at 11 a.m. by Michelle Martin, and your favorite Sandy Mallory will be taking over the noon hour, and she'll be here midday. And, of course, on to Marcellus Chappard, the bass man, takes his usual slot. And at 5 p.m., it's Anthony McCarthy. So new lineup here on WEAA, and you can join us next Thursday here from 4 to 7 p.m. at our WEAA studios. Anthony McCarthy, Michelle Martin, and I will be hosting an event here at our studios welcoming this new lineup. And all of you listeners, please join us here. Come and join the gathering. We are joined here in studio by Dr. Rhonda Wells Wilbon, who is Associate Professor and Chair of the Masters of Social Work Program here at Morgan State University and serves on the Board of Directors of the House of Ruth, Maryland. Dr. Wells Wilbon, good to have you in the studio.
Thank you.
And Jane Murphy is with us, who is Professor of Law at the University of Baltimore School of Law. And Jane Murphy, welcome to the studio as well.
Good to be here.
And you all are welcome here at 410-319-8888. Let me begin, as we talked before we went in, and I've been really thinking about this a great deal. When the reports came out last week, earlier in the week, about the horrendous plight of these women who have been held captive for 10 years, that police have been called to the house twice, at least twice, maybe more times, but at least twice. Reports of a naked woman on all fours running through the scene in the light and some other occurrence. And the police didn't bother to bang on the door, didn't bother to try to get a warrant, didn't bother kind of trying to investigate further what was going on inside the house. And it made me think, and the neighbors, you know, are neighbors, and some people said, well, we heard something going on, we didn't know what was going on in that house. But it led me to think about neither law enforcement, and many times, takes domestic violence very seriously or seriously enough, and B, that we in our own communities look at it and go, hands off, it's an internal matter. It's a family matter, not up to us. Doctor?
Yeah, I think in general we are not paying attention to a lot of things in our community. We've set up these silos around ourselves, and we're just not very in tune with even basic things that are happening right next door to us. And so certainly when there's some sort of abuses or some inappropriate behavior, often we don't know because we're not paying attention.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, I think in this case, certainly this guy Castro should have been within the focus of the police in connection with this case, the kidnapping, given his history. He had been involved in really severe domestic violence with his wife over the course of several years, both before and after these kidnappings started. And, you know, one of the last people to see one of the victims was his daughter. So you would think they'd investigate the family. You'd see his criminal history and pursue it. So it is sort of shocking to read the history of this case.
So what is it about our system in law enforcement? Let's just start there before we talk about our own communities. That domestic violence doesn't seem to be is either A, it's not taken seriously enough, or B, that the kind of dots are not connected, as you were just talking about, Jane Murphy, dots are not connected in our legal system to say, well, this person has domestic violence, needs to be watched for this, and isn't. How would you analyze that?
Well, I think part of the reality is so many people are actually involved in domestic violence, and so that we don't see these serious cases all the time, but at certain levels, perhaps many police officers themselves and other law, you know, enforcement officials, and just basic everyday people have a tendency to be involved in being abusive and displaying abusive behaviors. And so we do kind of turn the eye or turn around, you know, when we see these things happening with other people, because we often recognize and realize that it's happening within our own families. And so I think that we kind of normalized this behavior, certainly not at this level, but we've normalized it at smaller levels, which makes it easier for these kinds of behaviors to continue to grow and evolve and become very dangerous, like we see in this particular case.
I think it also may be a question of resources, too. I mean, there were, I think in this case, three instances that have been documented where his common-law wife called the police for criminal complaints or an order of protection in the last instance. And in two instances, she decided to drop the charges, maybe with an advocate or some kind of support within the criminal justice system. She might have seen other resources that would help her. I mean, she had four kids with him. There were probably emotional and economic reasons why she didn't pursue it. The last order for protection, apparently her lawyer didn't show up for the second stage hearing. Here in Maryland, we have places like the House of Ruth with lawyers right in the courthouse. So you would hope that there are some protections that could have existed with more resources that might make a difference, even the way we're approaching it in 2013 versus 2005 when the last incident happened here.
I'm just curious, you just said something, Rhonda Wells-Wilburn, about the kind of abuse that takes place and how common it is. So define what that means. I mean, what do you mean it's common? What kind of abuse are we talking about?
I think that physical violence within families is certainly more common than we want to talk about. There are lots of abuses that occur that are never reported. Abuse of children within families, including sexual abuse. And this case is being sensationalized because it's so horrific. But there are so many children who are captive in their own homes, have been sexually abused by their own fathers and stepfathers. And so it happens more often than these kinds of horrific cases. And so in some ways, it's really a challenge, I think, particularly for the women and children that I serve. When these kinds of things become so public, they feel like they have been no one pays attention to it until a serious case like this comes forward. But there are serious cases, most people believe, that are going on constantly all the time but never receive this kind of media of attention.
Another issue here, I think, is that we have historically seen, family violence as involving kind of different roots, different social causes, different behavior from violence against strangers. And with this case, the D.C. sniper case, even the Boston bombing case, we're beginning to see that those same patterns of control and criminal behavior that result in violence in the family also put strangers at risk, which should suggest to police that there's a reason to take these cases seriously, that not only are family members at risk, but this kind of controlling behavior might extend outside the home.
Folks, I'd like you to join us here, 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com or jump onto our Facebook pages. You can tweet us here at Mark Steiner, 410-319-8888. Your own thoughts on why there seems to be so much depth to and the kind of rampant nature of domestic violence in our culture. What is that? Why is that? 410-319-8888. Because one of the stats I realize, people always try to kind of would love to kind of lay domestic violence at the doorstep of communities of color, as we do in America all the time. But the reality is that those numbers of people who have been affected by and are violent against their intimate partners is equal across every class and racial line in America. This is not a problem of poor working people, or it goes across every class. So there's something fundamental going on here that are we at a point where we can figure out how to address it in ways we have not before? Either one, go ahead, Jane.
Well, I think one of the reasons that we view it that way, and in my practice with representing women who've experienced domestic violence in Baltimore, is that poor families tend to turn to the courts and the police and deal with it in a much more public way than people with resources. So we tend to,
people with resources do what that's different?
They might get leave with a credit card and check in at a Hilton hotel as opposed to going to a shelter, going to the House of Ruth. So in some ways, when I read about this case, I thought more about the legal system's response, law enforcement's response to poor families as opposed to their response to domestic violence. I think both are at issue here. But, you know, there were two children here that were abducted, and, you know, it just doesn't seem from reading about the history of this case that there was much in the way of investigative resources and others to respond to it. So do we care less about, you know, poor children? I'm not the first to ask that question.
Dr. Wilson, how do you look at this? I mean, I think that's probably true that we see more in poor working class families because that's what hits the press.
Mm-hmm.
And you can cover it up better when you have means. And maybe people go to counseling. Maybe people end up in therapy. But I don't know what the response is. But are we at a place where the kind of response to this can be more societally wide, that we can find ways of addressing this in ways we haven't thought about before? Because it's in the forefront, but we don't seem to be wrestling with it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, the whole domestic violence movement really started off as a feminist movement.
Right.
And I think in a lot of ways, we still see it in that way. But clearly, for those of us who have worked in the domestic violence movement in the trenches for years, we recognize and realize that this is so much bigger than a feminist issue. This is a family issue. This is an issue around oppression of women and children. You know, this is an issue around holding men accountable for their behavior. And I think that we all have a responsibility to be more involved and to do something about it. I'm always concerned when women are working together around this issue and there aren't very many men involved. More men need to be involved in, you know, helping to deal with this issue.
I mean, and I'm going to go to the phones here. Michael and Towson, you're the first caller up. We're going to get your call coming up. And we want to hear from men and women out there. 410-319-8888. Your thoughts on this. I mean, I remember years back, I did a program with a group that I don't know if House Ruth does this or not anymore, but they did when I did this program a bunch of years back, where men who were the abusers were in a group therapy kind of session addressing their own issues to try to deal with why they are abusive, why they have this violence towards women, where it comes from. Does that work, A? Is that still going on? I mean, is there something here that we can learn from?
Well, the groups certainly still go on. And I think for many men, it probably does work. But it's an ongoing process. One of the things that we also know is that many men who are so abusive also have suffered trauma and abuses, you know, in their own childhood experiences, which is something that we need to recognize. We need to work more with children who grow up in these homes before they grow up to become, you know, often the boys perpetrators, you know, often the girls victims themselves, you know, as adult women. And so I think more attention needs to be paid to the children who suffer in these situations. They often don't get the services that they really need to have.
Because those children are often going to become the next abuser.
Yeah, I mean, I think we see that in this case, apparently. You know, this person had a history of abuse from his father. And I think treatment programs like the Batterers Counseling Program are some of the more effective responses. A lot of my clients only go to court in order to get that relief. They want to stay. They want to keep their family together. They want to stay with the person who's the father of their children. They've had a long-term relationship with. So, I think in this case, you know, was it a condition of probation? Was it something that was available to this guy? And would it have some way, you know, prevented these crimes that extended outside the home? So those kinds of treatment programs, I think, are an important focus as opposed to a strictly legal response.
I'm going to come back even more to talk about what would be are legal responses important? Are there other ways we should be doing this other than legal responses? Because violence is violence, but we're also talking about families. We're also talking about kind of ending generations, eons perhaps, of misogynist thinking in men's heads, which is a huge piece of this. 410-319-8888. Oh, I'm sorry, we lost. Our gentleman was going to talk about women, but wish you would call back. We're about to go to you, Michael. 410-319-8888. If you call back, we'll come right to your call. Lolita, you're on the air. Hi, Lolita, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. Interesting topic. I know of a family that is having issues. There's three kids involved. The mother is, and she's working, but she's the only breadwinner in the household. the gentleman who's the children's father is a frustrated, angry young man. They oftentimes argue in front of the kids. On several occasions, he's hit the mother in front of the children. On the last occasion, the son, who's now just about, he's finishing middle school, intervened and stopped him from hitting his mother. But what kind of resources are there out there for kids who are living in a situation when the parents are choosing to stay in those situations because they don't feel like they, you know, she's helping him out by providing a roof over his head, for one. But she's not helping the kids out with the healthy environment that they're living in. She needs them for daycare so that she can work.
Mm-hmm.
And he half the time doesn't do daycare, and he's the father of the kids. So what do you suggest for those kinds of situations? I'm sure there's other young ladies living in situations quite similar.
That's a very tough question.
Yeah, I mean, I think that certainly being connected with the local domestic violence program, which most counties here in Maryland all have a program, perhaps through that you can get either counseling service there or be referred out for counseling services. There are lots of child psychologists that work and do very well with children, but children have to get to the resources and the services. And what we find often is that these mothers don't have the wherewithal to go that extra mile to get the resources that their children need because they themselves are still trying to get the resources that they need and be able to manage and the you know what's going on in their own lives.
Go ahead, Jen.
I think the caller's question really highlights some of the complexity of these situations. A mother in the situation you describe is really at risk. If her child talks to a teacher or a counselor, it may trigger, you know, the Department of Social Services investigating, which may then remove the children from the household and from her. She has an emotional bond with her father, as you said. She has an economic incentive to allow him to care for the kids. It is a very difficult situation, and it, you know, your question, I think, responds to some of the question in this case about why this woman let this go on, why this wife of Ariel Castro let this go on for so long. It is very difficult, and I think this woman you describe is at risk of losing her children if it's exposed.
On the way back to the phones, Verna, we're going to come right to your call, but I just want to follow up very quickly with what our guests have said here. This is one of the two difficult things here. I mean, let me start with A, and I'll go to the calls and come back to B. A is, what is a person supposed to do if you witness that kind of violence in somebody that you know? That's not your husband, not your wife, it's not your home. Could be next door, could be your cousin, could be somebody else. How do we begin to respond to that? I mean, because people are afraid to see somebody else go to jail, just people worried about destroying a family. So how do we respond to that? How do we counsel others to respond to this?
That's a tough question. I mean, it really is. But again, we go back to being citizens and being a part of the community and not living in these silos and really figuring out better ways to communicate with the people who live, you know, in our community. And I think that is the bigger issue, that maybe we don't know the answers. Maybe we can't, you know, figure it all out for ourselves. But I think the more that we talk to one another, the more answers, you know, can come forward. And so if we see this, perhaps we should report. Or if we don't think that is something that we feel comfortable with, I think that at least talking to the persons involved, particularly the woman, but having a relationship ahead of time would be more helpful. And so our relationships with each other, I think, lays a foundation for people being able to feel comfortable talking about these things when issues occur. But in the absence of having a relationship, I think it's very difficult for people to intervene unless it's something so horrific that you really have no choice.
I mean, I agree. I think this case has made me rethink the way we live, the way we relate to our neighbors, the way we relate in our community. I mean, a woman in the situation that was described is probably fairly isolated if she's working all the time to support the family, and there's probably, you know, her partner is encouraging that isolation. So, you know, if you're a neighbor, you could offer to watch the kids, you know, give her some alternative to having this person in the household who's, you know, it may not be in that first conversation anything happens, but if you sense some support out there and some accountability to the community, it's less likely these things can go on to the extent where someone, you know, is hurt very badly.
And I agree with that. I think that the more people live in isolation, the more likely these things can happen. But if people talk to someone, even just a neighbor, when people have those ongoing relationships, then they're more likely, when something is going wrong, to talk to someone that they've already felt comfortable talking with. So with women who suffer from domestic violence, if they're isolated, which abusers often do, abusers often isolate women from their family and their friends because they know that if they do have these ongoing relationships, that eventually they will tell someone or someone will see something about them that is different and begin to ask questions. So that is actually one of the things that feeds into allowing this to happen, and that is the isolation. So when we see people living in isolation, we should be concerned about that. Most people don't want to live so isolated that they don't have any contact with their family and friends.
410-319-8888. I'm going to kind of follow up with another question, given some of the stats one of my producers came up with this morning. 410-319-8888. We have with us in the studio Dr. Rhonda Wells-Wilbin, who you just heard, Chair of the Masters of Social Work Program here at Morgan State University, Jane Murphy, Professor of Law at the University of Baltimore School of Law, 410-319-8888. Verna, you're on the air. Verna, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hello?
Verna, you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Turn on your radio so we can hear what you're saying.
Okay, I'm
thank
not
you.
Here, but I'm going to turn it down.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, good morning. I would like to yes, I'm here. Can you hear me?
We can.
Okay, the radio is lower down. Anyway, I have the answer and the solution to rape, specifically rape against young children, because this is such a promiscuous country. They do not promote moral laws, which are on the books, the law books. Moral laws such as indecent exposure, moral laws such as fornication. Yes, I'm going way back, old-fashioned, but that's how you're going to have a moral society. The solution for rape is public castration. There's not one male in the entire world who would like to live without his member. If that is done, you would not have to worry about rape for years to come, because they would tell their sons, they would tell their friends, they would tell any strange man they knew that this is the penalty that you pay for rape, and that would stop it.
Verna, okay? Thank you. That actually addresses the question, though, because rape is a violent act.
Correct.
And people would argue, castrated or not, the act of violence would still take place, whether or not somebody was castrated or not, because this argument has happened before.
I mean, yeah, I assume someone is you know, given to violence and control, they would find another way to commit those acts of
violence.
Yeah,
I don't think castration is the answer, because yes, we, you know, that doesn't take away whatever psychological disorder that's going on. They will still figure out a way to control and victimize other people. So I don't think that that's the answer, but I do think that it might curve a little bit of some violent activity if we started publicly castrating men.
Might make somebody think twice. But here we are in the 21st century, where women have women's issues and women's rights, and women as leaders are coming to the fore, challenging age-old male assumptions about who has power and who controls what goes on around us. We're not there yet, but I mean, it's clearly we're in a different place than we ever have been before. So what does that say about how we need to address where we are when it comes to domestic violence? I mean, one of the numbers I saw was 3 women every day are murdered by their domestic partner in America. That's insane. That's a lot of, so there's countless other women being beaten every day. And 15% of domestic partners of abuse are men, but the vast majority of people who are hurt in those relationships are women. So the question is, I'm just curious what, how you both will wrestle, where we go from here. You said earlier, Jane Murphy, that we have to kind of find responses that aren't necessarily always legal responses. So, A, what should be our responses, and how do we even get to the prevention aspect of this?
Yeah, well, I think that there is kind of, we've evolved from thinking about domestic violence as a private matter that the law has no role in to over the 80s and 90s, a really vigorous legal response, some problem with implementation of the laws, but more and more resources going into a legal system. And a lot of scholars are beginning to think that response works for some women at some level of violence, but not all women. And it's come at the cost of resources to other responses, like more counseling for looking at the batters and thinking about, you know, restorative justice, forgiveness perhaps, you know, counseling for batters, as well as services for children. Economic supports for women who, if they choose to leave, if they're, you know, if that's the way they want to address it, have that economic support. So I think we're at a stage where we need to begin to think about a broader spectrum of responses and more creatively, and understand that women who experience domestic violence are you know, not all the same, and are not in need of the same response.
And I would just add that, you know, education is so important. You know, from the time that we're children in elementary school, there should be education around anger management, problem solving, conflict resolution skills. We don't do nearly enough of this, and I think that it should happen ongoingly throughout our lives, because I do think that people get very frustrated with everyday life. And if you don't really know how to problem solve well and communicate your feelings and frustrations well, you know, this kind of stuff does bottle up inside of people, and often in a very negative kind of way.
I guess we're out of time, I'm being told. All of a sudden, I didn't realize we had a few minutes left. So I want to thank our guests for being here. If there's more questions I want to raise, I'll leave you with this thought, and we can come back to it next time. Is one of the most frightening things that ever happened to me in my life was when I was working as a co-therapist with a group of men who, in prison, who were not there for committing crimes against women, but with us, well, we knew they had, so we brought them together, and we did this group about men and women, and the depth of hatred and anger towards women in that group was frightening. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's where I think we have to begin, is what is going on in our male heads about women that fuels this.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Maybe we'll begin that. The next topic, I want to thank you both for being here. Jane Murphy, Professor of Law at the University of Baltimore School of Law. Dr. Rhonda Wells-Wilbin, Associate Professor and Chair of Masters of Social Work Program and Chair of the Master of Social Work Program here at Morgan State University and on the Board of Directors of House of Ruth. Thank you both so much.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you.
I'll remind you, the Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Bobby Marvin Holmes, Mark Henry, and Stephanie Mavronis. Our engineer is Andrea Melton. Our intern is Lila Warshaw. Theme music by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. You can hear this show again, podcast our shows at steinershow.org, and you can download our podcasts on iTunes and listen to them there as well. And folks, we're going to take off now. It's time now to go to Michelle Martin and Tell Me More.